Good morning, everyone. I'd like to call to order this hearing of the House Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. Today being March 7th, there is a quorum. The quorum is present. And the first order of business is approval of the minutes of March 5th, which are in the packets. Representative Bierman.
Madam Chair, I move the approval of the minutes from March the 5th, please.
Okay, is there any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails, and the minutes are approved. Thank you. Okay, the first bill on the agenda today is House File 3533. Representative Fisher is coming forward, and Representative Fisher is on the committee, and his motion is going to be to that House File 3533 be laid over for possible inclusion, right, Representative Fisher?
Yes, Madam Chair, that is my motion, is to have it laid over.
Okay. Very good. And so, Representative Fisher, to your bill.
Thank you. Chair Liebling and committee. I appreciate the opportunity to present House File 3533, which is a very bipartisan bill. It's been heard already in the Human Services Policy Committee. We've had a very good discussion, and this is a bill that I think everybody can get around. It's allowing our counties to get together with the Department of Human Services so that we can continue to build out these awesome programs that several counties are already doing in providing medical services through the Medicaid system to their people in their counties. This has proven to be a very successful program. It's had issues in the reason it's not more expansive than it is now because there's been some complications between the Department of Human Services and the counties on trying to set these up. And what we're doing here is allowing the groups to come together to come back with how do we do this in a better way so that people don't have to use court suits or whatever to get things done, and allow the counties who are closest to the people and that are in need and to the local systems to be able to make sure they can put together a health care program, health coverage program for those on the Medicaid system. From what I've seen in the past when this has been in counties that are doing this right now that are doing this, they've been very effective in not only making sure that we're getting better outcomes, but also making sure that we get better rates going to the local providers in the area. We've heard testimony in the past in this community where we've had pharmacies closing down because of the reimbursement rates from the MCOs that run the Medicaid program are at such a rate that they aren't able to continue to sustain themselves. We see the pressure on the local rural clinics that are out there, the independent clinics. They have been having trouble because they don't get the same reimbursement rates from the NCOs, but the counties have been able to do that because they're running the programs themselves and are able to do such a good job. They're able to get better reimbursement rates, which helps makes our rural community stronger, make sure that we're protecting our independent providers out there so they continue to be successful. There's also many other things that are possible out here that will improve outcomes in our system. What I'd like to do is turn it over to our testifiers because I could go on for way too long on what the potential of this program could do for us.
All right. Thank you, Representative Fisher. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and go ahead and give your testimony.
My name is Greg Krieger, and I'm a Steele County Commissioner for District 5 in Steele County in southern Minnesota. Madam Chair and members of the Health Finance Policy Committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today on behalf of House File 3533, CARMA Development Bill. CARMA, or as we know it in Steele County, county-based purchasing, was instituted by law by a bipartisan coalition of legislators in 1997. Steele County became a county-based county over 20 years ago and has been taking care of our Medicare and Medicaid clients with quality health care close to home ever since. Innovative programs like Care Connectors and Healthy Pathways, programs that were designed and implemented by South Country Health Alliance, have helped our clients attain and maintain better health and well-being because of personal contacts by concerned team members at South Country that are committed to the best possible health outcomes for all their clients and doing so with providers close to home. This not only provides for easier access to quality health care, but creates a relationship that our clients have become able to rely on. We have had our challenges with DHS in the past about county-based authority in public program procurement. But as of late, with the help of the Association of Minnesota Counties and the collaboration of DHS and CBPs, our aim is to do better together for the people we serve. This bill seeks legislative direction and authority, and it requires the commissioner to work in collaboration with counties to develop details of the rural-focused CARMA model and bring back a detailed implementation plan to the legislature in 2025, along with model legislation. 3533 will allow us to move beyond the legal dispute over current state law, but it is an important step forward to build on the successes of county-based purchasing by creating greater alignment and collaboration with DHS. But most of all, this is an important step toward innovation to improve and strengthen the county-based model to further integrate and expand the common goals of better health and well-being to all of our public program enrollees with county public health and social services to address social determinants of health and deliver better and longer-lasting care outcomes. On behalf of over 90,000 county-based purchasing enrollees and the counties that support their health care needs, I urge you to support this truly nonpartisan bill. I would like to take this time to thank Representative Liebling and Fisher for their support of 3533 and for your time today, and I hope I have helped you see why this bill is an important first step in creating better health care close to home for over 90,000 of our constituents. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Krieger. Appreciate it. Next, we have Matt Freeman. Welcome to the committee.
Chair Liebling, members of the committee, Representative Fisher, my name is Matt Freeman. I'm the Human Service Policy Analyst for the Association of Minnesota Counties, here to testify on behalf of Minnesota's 87 counties and urge you to support House File 3533, the County-Administered Rural Medical Assistance, or CARMA, Development Bill. This legislation is a result of a year-long process of collaboration between AMC, Minnesota's three county-based purchasing plans, and in cooperation with the Minnesota Department of Human Services. AMC and its commissioners, who manage Minnesota's three CBP plans, are excited to be working on CARMA with DHS. We're hopeful that the final proposal will highlight and build on CBP's 40-year history of success at innovation, responsiveness, transparency, reinvestment in rural health care infrastructure, and increasing access to care, and better results for enrollees. AMC and its commissioners know the importance of local and county-based care delivery, integration with other county services, partnering with our local providers, and supporting our local communities. And it makes for great care and outstanding outcomes for those that we serve. We're excited for this opportunity to do even better and create the next generation of county-based innovation to better serve rural residents and communities with an even stronger and more cost-effective outcomes. This bill offers the opportunity to collaboratively flesh out the details of a new and improved model, and we appreciate your consideration. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Freeman. So I have Dan Andreessen and then another testifier, but I don't know, Mr. Andreessen, are you want to testify on the bill or on the amendment or both? Now? He said the amendment. Okay. All right. Okay. So are there anyone else who wants to testify on the bill? Okay, not seeing anyone. So that being the case, I'm going to offer the amendment at this point. And so I'm going to offer the A2 amendment. And before I discuss the A2 amendment, let me just say that we're laying the bill over. And so now Senator Abler, who was a member of this committee for many, many years, used to say, I've got a placeholder. This is just a placeholder. So this amendment is somewhat of a placeholder. It's meant to start the discussion, but it's got a few different pieces, which I will walk through. So first of all, the first section of the bill, state-funded cost-sharing reductions, is kind of not related to CARMA, really. This is something that was actually in many versions of our omnibus bill last year. It was taken out at the very end. This was actually, it's a way to help people in the individual market who are struggling with unaffordable out-of-pocket costs, who have market plans through MinSure, who pay a lot for their premiums, even though we, of course, have federal subsidies right now that reduce the cost of premiums. They're still struggling with their out-of-pocket costs and oftentimes unable to actually access their care. So this is a plan that will have a fiscal note, and it did have one last year, and maybe I'll ask Mr. Harney to just give you all the ballpark of that. We will, of course, get it fiscal noted again. The language may need to be tweaked, but this is just a proposal that would help with some of the problems in the individual market right now. Okay? So that's what that's doing there. And you can read the language. It starts in plan year 25 for people who are between 200 and 250% of the federal poverty level. And it essentially applies some state funding to buy down those out-of-pocket costs. And it does this through the plans that exist now and has us repaying them. So this is actually something that I don't know if we have anybody from MinSure here today, but this is something that MinSure last year had said that they could do, that was workable, that was kind of using existing systems. It's a simpler way to get some more immediate help to those people who really need it. And then beginning in plan year 2026, it would then apply to people who are between 250%, 300% of federal poverty. So that is what that is. The next section of the bill, section 2, the only thing that does is change a date. So this is language from current law that we passed last year asking DHS to develop some plans for a direct payment system. In other words, no secret, we want to get the private insurance companies out of our public plan space. And so we asked DHS to look at some things for us. We realize there's complications about how the money flows in the state and so on and how the contracting is done. So we had asked for a plan. Given that we are talking now about the CARMA model, it's going to require DHS to do some calculating, and the date on the CARMA model for DHS to come back with the details is January 15, 2025. So this is my kind of attempt to have a conversation with DHS about moving up some of the other analysis, and I think this will continue to be worked on, because what we don't want to do is send DHS in a bunch of different non-productive directions. We realize they have limited ability to work on things, but again, this is for discussion, asking to move up that date to make it consistent with the CARMA bill. And then finally, when I looked at CARMA and had some discussions with Hennepin Health, which you all know is a publicly owned MCO in the public program space, question kind of came up, why can't the non-rural counties do this too? So that's what this is. You know, if we can, there may be different considerations with the federal government, but, you know, kind of what's good for the goose should be good for the gander, and we should be able to think about, this is just another way to perhaps approach the idea of having a public programs that are truly public. So that's what this is doing here. The language is just absolutely modeled on what's in the CARMA bill, and so you can see what that is. So with that, I think we would first call up, I have Dr. Krishnan Subramanian, who is going to testify on part of the bill, and then we'll go to Mr. Andreessen. So welcome to the committee. Thank you for being here.
Good morning, Chair Liebling, esteemed representatives. My name is Krishnan Subramanian, and I'm a pediatrician at Hennepin Healthcare. And I also am the chief medical officer at Hennepin Health. So I say I'm kind of a county employee, and I kind of work at an insurance company. So let me explain. Hennepin Health is a county-owned and administered health care organization. We are a managed care organization that serves only Hennepin County residents who are eligible for Medicaid. We have no employer-sponsored programs. We have no private programs. We have a very small Minnesota care program. And while we would love to cover all Hennepin County residents who meet eligibility, we actually see specifically an awesome group of neighbors who have medical ailments that meet at the intersection of the social drivers of health. 36% of our membership have some sort of mental health condition. 19% have substance use disorder. And thus, we as a county begin to think, what is our responsibility and opportunity to augment services to ensure that we're not just taking care of the health care of individuals, but of the human care of individuals? The member who visits the emergency room 6 times in a month, can we connect them with our social workers to ensure they have housing and a primary care doctor? The individual with substance use disorder, would a peer counselor help them through this very challenging moment? Our work has yielded great results. We've seen a 2/3 reduction in our readmissions for folks with SUD simply because of a peer counselor involvement. At the end of the day, we use Medicaid dollars to ensure that the complex health needs of our members are met. And if there are any dollars left at the end of the day, we ensure that the complex social needs of individuals are met. While we ensure the day-to-day, we also use the opportunity to innovate and create models that meet our members where they're at. In the last year, we have stood up programs that include a spiritual care collaboration with mental care providers, an SUD peer counselor, which I have demonstrated shows great results, a car seat program, a launching of a group visit program. We have one team that took a coordinated care model grant that we gave and leveraged that into a large federal grant to ensure mental and physical health needs of our members. In the year where medical expenditure is a lot and there are no profits, we as a county still walk by our members. And so as you consider county-administered rural and non-rural programming, just know that we at Hennepin Health are here in your backyard. We are happy to share our learnings and experience, and we thank you all for your consideration on this matter. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Mr. Andreessen. If you can stay a few moments, just not at the table, but just in case there are questions, that'd be great. Welcome to the committee. And you could have a seat in the back there. It would be fine. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dan Andreessen with the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. Just offering a couple of thoughts on the amendment. First of all, Section 1, the Council supports the cost-sharing reductions that are in that section. We are concerned about the financial cliff Minnesotans on the individual markets are going to face in 2026 with the sunset of the federal ARPA subsidies and the state's reinsurance program. The Council contracted with RAND this summer to model the potential impacts, and that report found that losing those two programs could cause as much as a 50% increase in rates in that market and result in 93,000 Minnesotans going without insurance. Although costly, these cost-sharing reductions will improve availability for those who purchase their insurance on the individual market. However, it's important to note that these cost-sharing reductions only address affordability for a targeted part of the population, and the reinsurance program is a proven mechanism for a broad-based approach. Section 2, keeping in mind your comments, Madam Chair, we are concerned about shortening the deadline for DHS to put in an implementation plan. The Council continues to be opposed to the elimination of managed care, but are worried that if we rush this through, there won't be adequate time to fully analyze the change and how it's going to operate. As we said last session, many national reports have found that managed care outperforms fee-for-service models because of structured care coordination and the use of payment withholds by DHS to ensure that MCOs meet performance targets and quality improvement goals. Performance metrics total $651 million in calendar year 2025 alone, with another $786 million withhold to shift state budget cycles for a combined $1.5 billion. This bill does not address how that shift will be addressed or how quality improvements will be incentivized. One of the advantages of the managed care model is financial predictability. with health plans taking on the financial risk for the state. MCOs are regularly audited for financial accountability and face strict requirements on how money must be spent. And if they don't match those requirements, they have to return those payments to the state. And then lastly, regarding Section 3, as the state embarks on this and just broadly the CARMA model, we're concerned about enrollee choice being eliminated. The state and federal government both have recognized the value of ensuring public program enrollees have more than one choice, and this takes a step backwards, potentially eliminating those options. Removing choice means a person only has one option, and if that one option doesn't suit your medical needs, you have no option at all. So appreciate that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Andreessen. So I think, you know, since we're laying over the bill and this is all going to be laid over, I think we could maybe, just for management's sake, take a vote now on the amendment and then discuss the entire bill as it's amended, and then you can all discuss whichever parts you want.
Madam Chair.
Representative Kwan.
Thank you. I'd like to divide the amendment, separating out subdivision 3. Yeah, that's section 3.
Okay, so, all right, Representative Kwan, if you want to do that, which part do you want to vote on first?
I'm fine with the chair deciding what order.
Well, it's your decision.
Okay.
Which part do you
then,
want
then I would go to the vote and discussion on the non-rural medical assistance model, just because with the turmoil.
You don't have to explain, just that's your choice. So I should ask if this is divisible. Mr. Chun? It is, okay. All right, great. So in order to get the bill in the form, I'm not the author of the underlying bill, but Representative Fisher, let you comment on this.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will say that, first of all, in terms of the overall amendment for each section,
Section 3, which
on
is
Section 3, I think it's important that we make sure that we add this in. I mean, I've heard from our local counties that are in the metropolitan area, some of them are interested in being able to do the same opportunities that our rural counties are. And I think anything that can build on the system, and there will still be choice out there because you'll still have opportunities where the people can choose either the county system or the fee-for-service system, which is what happens in some areas now. So I think this would be something that we want to make sure we're casting a bigger net and having as many people involved, and this is how we make better decisions for going forward to have better health care.
Okay, and I'm sorry, Representative Kwan, I should have allowed you to speak first. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And part of it is because of the sort of progressing court questions in this area and the modifications being made to the existing program, I think it would be prudent to first get the changes and the stability in the existing programs before we delve into an entirely new area, plus a little bit different interpretation of language than the author, because on 3.28, it says, deliver care on a single plan basis to all medical assistance enrollees. And to me, that is looking at a constraining effort to decrease option and choice. And frankly, that I think is troublesome to me, but I know some people think that that would be advantage. But the reason for dividing it was, let's go ahead and fix the, turmoil and the issues with the existing program before we look at expanding it to a large portion of the population of the state. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, and Representative New Brindley, did you want to comment on this portion of the amendment, or did you want to wait and comment on that? Okay. All right. All in favor of adoption of Section 3 of the A2 Amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Section 3 is adopted. And to the rest of the amendment, Representative Fisher, did you want to comment on the rest?
I will say that I'm very open to what's being proposed here. This is something that is going to continue to evolve as we go forward. I would like to make sure the discussion continues in this area. And I've also been noted for doing this to other bills out there when I see it a good idea that can be added on instead of crafting a new bill is doing amendments to help make we can keep things going as things have popped up as we see bills and discussion ideas occur.
Okay, thank you. So all in favor of the remainder of the A2 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. So to the bill as amended, Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Fisher. I am trying to understand, and it's a little complicated. I'm trying to understand lines 3.27 to 3.30 of the amendment. It is different than the language for the rural, so we're setting up two different systems here. And my question is, and I'm trying to make sure I understand it, and perhaps the chair would, I mean, I'm sure she knows all of these answers, but currently, are MCOs required to provide at least two plans in a given county?
Well, I think, I'm not exactly sure what you're asking here, Representative New Brindley, that an MCO would not be providing more than one plan. If you're asking,
thank you,
does the law require more than one plan? And is that what you're asking?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, no, that was it. So MCOs can currently provide one plan. So this is also saying that the county program could provide a single plan. However, Representative Fisher, I'm hoping that you can clarify your words. And this language stuck out to me particularly, and I'm hoping that what you just said is not correct. But what you just said is that the options will be, they will still have choice, and they can choose either this county plan or fee-for-service. Will those be the only two options?
Representative Fisher.
Madam Chair, thank you. Representative Brindley, from my understanding of what we're putting together here is this would allow the counties to put their plans together for what they'd like to do. In terms of if I understand how we currently operate in the market, need clarification on this, is that DHS currently has to take bids from all, you know, the different, you know, who wants to do it, whether it's county or an MCO, and then they decide where they want to bid. As of right now, there's nothing specifically saying you have to do all of them or none of them. I think that's some of the things that they're going to have in the discussions they're putting the model together. I do know that one of the options that is still going to be out there is that still making sure that you have the also opting in for the fee for service. I know that's also going to be discussed as one of that. So these are the things that I think the model is going to come back for, but from my understanding, what I'm hearing on discussions right now, that I'm not hearing that it would specifically say that the MCOs would not be out there. What it's saying is it's allowing the counties to specifically be able to organize for those that right now are not organized in it. Does that answer your question?
Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It does, and frankly, it's been litigated, right, that in Minnesota we believe in having choice. And so I just want to ensure this language was just a little bit odd. It's not in the underlying bill applying to the rural model as well. And so that throws up some red flags for me. But I want to ensure that, and frankly, like I said, it's already been litigated that in Minnesota, unless that law is also changed, we actually do believe in giving consumers real choices. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Well, so Representative New Brindley, what language were you speaking of here? Could you repeat your lines that you were pointing to?
The 3.27 to 3.30. It's in the amendment.
Yes.
That same language is not in the underlying bill for the rural model.
Right. So, Representative Brindley, that, of course, was added by me, mm-hmm. not by Representative Fisher. And the idea being that if we were going to have a single plan in a county, in a non-rural county, you know, the big difference, I think, or one of the big differences is that in the rural counties, of course, there aren't that many providers. So you're going to want them all or most of them in your network. Otherwise, you're not going to have a network. And even then, you're going to have struggle sometimes to get a network. So this, of course, in a non-rural county, you have many more providers. And if you're going to have one plan, it's in order to not be cutting out providers who are capable and willing to serve the population. This was the idea why I added that language that was not in the other. So I mirrored, that was very, very astute of you to notice, and I mirrored the language that was in the KARMA bill, but I did make that one change for that reason. And again, you know, this is all for discussion. It's being laid over. You know, it may or may not be workable. This, you know, the great minds all have to look at this and work it through. As far as what you were saying about the law, we could maybe get somebody back up to discuss this. I believe the litigation is still going. And I think that part of the problem was ambiguity in the law. People, different parties have taken different positions. And I think that this is part of an effort to somewhat settle the underlying KARMA bill is part of an effort to, I think, settle that litigation. And I'm not exactly sure what kind of federal authority or change it might require. And by the same token, the part I put in may indeed require some federal authority. We just don't know at this point. Representative Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you so much for that clarification. I really do appreciate that. So the intention here is to ensure access to providers, mm-hmm. It sounds like, maybe?
Absolutely.
And so I would just suggest that that we want to be careful, because and if I am misquoting, please correct me. I'm sure that you will. But so what it sounds like you're saying is that it would allow these non-rural counties to offer only the KANMA plan because they would have an expansive group of providers. And if my understanding is correct of what you just said, I would just be concerned because the language says as long as they contract with all the healthcare providers that that agree to accept the contract terms. So that doesn't necessarily mean that we will that this will encompass tons and tons of providers. It just means that if they are willing to accept the terms, then they must contract with them. So I don't know that would solve that problem more broadly, but I really appreciate the clarification. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I kind of like your amendment. I like the idea of focusing on trying to leverage social services with healthcare provision. Representative New Brindley, you know, tackled that paragraph, and the thing that struck out for me in that line 3.27 was the KANMA model may allow. And I think the intent is that it's providing an option on top of what's currently provided. But I'm wondering if they also can decide not to allow. If they may allow, could that model also not allow?
Well, thank you, Representative Nadeau. It's a good question. I mean, this is kind of, you know, the rules haven't been written.
Yeah.
And we don't have the program, both of these programs need further design. So I think that's why we're saying, my concept, at least for this, and I think the KARMA concept, is that counties have the option to do this or not to do it, continue with the old model.
Yeah.
And, you know, my hope would be that they would see that this is to their benefit, to the benefit of the citizens of their county, that they're able to do this more integrated model and not have to waste resources competing with other plans. And these are our public programs, after all, and these are elected officials who are ultimately responsible to their constituencies just as we are to ours. So, yeah. You know, that's the idea. It's really, you know, to the degree that it's, you know, I guess I'm hesitant to, I would suggest that members not focus too much on individual words, although I appreciate the thinking about it and the the questions, because it will help us think through these things. But, you know, it, again, it's kind of a work in progress.
Okay.
So thank you very much for that.
And just to follow up.
Representative Doe.
In Subdivision 1, so as I read this, and I think that, number one, I don't even know what the, you know, kind of what the out-of-pocket costs are for the population that is, you know, 200 to 250% of FPG. And I'm not sure if anybody here knows that, but what struck me in this and with the pending sunset of reinsurance, and I'm hoping, and maybe you can clarify, I'm hoping that this, and if it is, I guess that's my question, is are we looking at this as a possible replacement for reinsurance, or are we assuming that we're gonna refund a reinsurance for the plans, or what is the thought there? That's what came up to me, and I'm not trying to be super critical. I'm just really curious on this one.
Yeah, Representative Nadeau, thank you for that question. So this is not intended to replace reinsurance. It's intended to supplement right now and into the future. But I think we have to wrestle with the reinsurance issue separately. There probably will be other language coming forward to attempt to address that piece. You know, I've never supported the reinsurance that we have now in the way it's done, okay? There are other ways to do it. I think it was 1 or 2 years under Governor Dayton when we did it as a direct subsidy to the policyholder to help buy down their out-of-pocket cost, but their premium cost. And so we may have to do something like that. I do not support the way we do it now because it really operates in a way that is not transparent, not guaranteed to actually flow through. And I just saw some, there's been some analysis that it probably raises rates, actually. So, you know, there's a lot more discussion to come on this, but just to directly answer your question, no, this was not intended to replace reinsurance. We still have to work on that.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, other discussion to the bill as amended? All right. Seeing none, House File 3533 as amended is laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you very much, Representative Fisher, and
thank you
to the testifiers. Okay, the next bill on the calendar is Representative Akam, House File 4096. And while she's coming up, I will just say that members may not realize what a broad jurisdiction we have in this committee, but because we do water in the Department of Health, this is actually very squarely within our jurisdiction, even though we don't talk about it all that much. And so today's our opportunity. So welcome, Representative Akam, and Representative Akam is going to move that House File 4096 be laid over for possible inclusion.
That is my motion.
So, Representative Akam, to your bill. And there's no amendment to it, correct?
No amendment.
All right.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, for the opportunity to present House File 4096. This bill provides necessary technical amendments to the Minnesota statutes governing permitting of groundwater thermal exchange devices. Groundwater thermal exchange devices, including aquifer thermal energy storage technology, also called AETS, have the potential to provide the benefits of geothermal energy in high-density locations across our state where it might not otherwise be available because of the lack of space available or needed to deploy traditional geothermal technology. The technology components are the same, and the permitting and regulations are similar to what is already allowed under state statute. Projects proposing this non-consumptive use of water contained in Minnesota's aquifers to extract thermal energy provide an additional tool to decarbonize the hard-to-decarbonize area of the state's new and existing building stock. In Minnesota, buildings make up 40% of greenhouse gas emissions because of our weather and the need to both heat and cool buildings. So this can be an effective tool and also environmentally safe. The current language has very low gallons per minute threshold for projects, which prohibits the allocation of this technology to anything beyond the size of a small residence. House File 4096 in no way changes the obligation of owners, developers, and operators of these systems to operate it in a manner that is consistent with current state regulations and rules. Compliance with the current rules and regulations will allow the safe utilization of aquifers as an energy resource for the state. There are two projects in the metro region that offer the chance to decarbonize redevelopment and propose thousands of square feet of new buildings utilizing this aquifer thermal energy storage system. These projects are, one is in Minneapolis and the other is the Heights, located on the Upper East Side of St. Paul. These projects will include low-income and affordable housing, senior housing, commercial retail, and so forth. In addition, this technology is also a key feature of Mayo Clinic's transformative delivery project in Rochester. Two new clinical buildings totaling nearly 2 million square feet of space will combine innovative care concepts and digital technologies in a physical space like never seen before. These projects will miss out on the opportunity to connect this renewable energy resource if this bill is not passed this session. So with me today, I have Michael Auger from Evergreen Energy, who can elaborate a little bit. And I also want to point out that in packets and probably easier to see if looking online or on your printed, or not on printed stuff that printed out black and white, but it's a visual of the technology, which I think can be helpful just for people's understandings. So with that, Madam Chair, I will turn it back.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Michael Auger, and I am Senior Vice President and Chief Business Officer of District Energy St. Paul and Evergreen Energy. Based in St. Paul, Evergreen Energy develops, operates, manages, and maintains district energy systems across the United States. I'm here to speak in support of House File 4096. Since 2018, Evergreen has been working on deploying aquifer thermal energy storage as a potential energy source for district energy systems in Minnesota. During that time, Evergreen engaged collaboratively with the Minnesota Department of Health to discuss permitting these projects, along with permitting test wells needed for project due diligence. In late 2023, on the cusp of test well drilling in Minneapolis for the 2800 East Lake Street project, or Longfellow Community Energy, as it will become to be known, Evergreen was informed by the department that upon additional review and guidance, it was apparent that the types of projects proposed in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Rochester were not permittable under the current state statute. Through further discussion with the department, it became apparent that amending the statute to allow for a larger gallons per minute flow rate would be acceptable, given that aquifer thermal energy storage projects do not consume water, and current rules and regulations are in place to already ensure that the projects would be deployed in a manner that protected the state's natural resources. We thank the department for its commitment to collaboration that has led us to this point. They have been a good partner and have been very responsive to our questions. As mentioned in Representative Akam's introduction, there are currently three projects under development in the state that are at a critical moment where permit clarity is needed now in order to successfully deploy aquifer thermal energy storage systems. The 2800 East Lake Street project in Minneapolis, the Heights project in St. Paul on the former Hillcrest Golf Course location, and the project under development at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester. All three projects are able to deliver carbon-free heating and cooling energy to redevelopment projects that will include low-income and affordable housing, commercial, retail, light industrial space, and healthcare. Put simply, if House File 4096 does not move forward, it is likely that a majority of these buildings will have to resort to using natural gas for heating or other less efficient means for cooling. I'd like to comment just a little bit on the 100 cap that's proposed as well. We're comfortable with that. To deploy these projects takes time, effort, and mobilization. We think that that allows the department time to review and study as we move forward, and acknowledges that this is just the beginning, though, and there will be additional opportunities as this moves forward. I thank you to the committee for the opportunity to testify in support of House File 4096, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your testimony. Yeah, so we'll go to the next testifier, and if you Well, if there are questions, we'll call you back up. So, Jack Roll, welcome to the committee. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. My name is Jack Roll. I'm a facility project manager with Mayo Clinic in Rochester. I'm here today to share our support, Mayo's support of House 4096. I'm also joined by my colleague, Jody Larson, a fellow engineer, and we will be happy to answer any questions. First, I would like to thank Senator or Representative Akam for authoring this important legislation, for the partnership of our colleagues with Evergreen. Second, I'd like to briefly share why Mayo intends to use this technology in our Bolt Forward Unbound in Rochester project. As we embark on the Unbound project, a project to build nearly 2 million square feet of space that will be used to deliver the most advanced health care to our patients at our Rochester campus, we want to do so in a way that both meets or exceeds the needs of our patient, yet is achieved while being good stewards to the environment. After much research, planning, and design, we believe this geothermal technology provides us the best opportunity to not only achieve these goals, but also aligns with Mayo Clinic's commitment to the Department of Energy's Better Health, Better Climate Challenge. Given the size of this project, we plan to utilize technology that is the technology to a greater extent than what is allowed by current law. This is why Mayo and Evergreen are in favor of House File 4096. We look forward to the opportunity to work with MDH and the DNR as we begin to implement these technologies, and we truly appreciate your support today. Again, Jody and I are happy to answer any questions you may have about the project, the Unbound Mayo project, and the application of this geothermal technology at Mayo Clinic. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else who wants to testify for or against the bill? Okay, I'm not seeing anyone. I wonder if we could have, is there someone here from MDH whose area this is? Yeah, could you please come down? Anywhere. And let me just ask, Mr. Harney, is there a, I assume we've got a fiscal note in the.
Yeah, Madam Chair, correct. There's a fiscal note request active.
Okay. Great. Hi. Could you just introduce yourself for the record?
Yes, I'm Teresa Purrington. I'm the well manager for the well management section at the Department of Health.
Okay. And could you say your name again slowly?
Teresa Purrington.
Purrington?
Yes.
Okay. Ms. Purrington, thank you for coming down. So, you know, I just wanted to check in with you. I mean, it's just because in the past, I know this was controversial with the department, and I just wanted to, you know, get from the horse's mouth, so to speak. I know I don't, of course, I believe what the testifiers have said, but I just thought it would be good to also have the department comment on the bill since it directly is, you know, affects the Department of Health. So can you kind of give us, you know, I don't mean to put you on the spot. I am, of course, but but could you comment on it as well?
Madam Chair, committee members, thank you for asking that question. I will respond with that MDH supports climate energy and or climate change and energy needs while upholding our authority to protect public health and groundwater. So for this, we appreciate the support that we've provided to get the technical assistance to help move this forward with Evergreen Energy and Mayo.
Okay. So I take it it's not, obviously it's not an initiative of the department. I get that, but the department feels that, you know, you would be able to do this, I assume, with some resources, and that we're not, I mean, my big concern just as a policymaker, of course, is to protect our groundwater. I'm sure everybody's, you know, and so we look to the department to for assurance that we're not, you know, doing the wrong thing here, and so that's what I'm kind of asking you for, I guess.
This language, thank you, Madam Chair. This language allows the department to review information and obtain information through the permitting process. This also will allow us to review that data to protect public health the safety of the groundwater and to ensure that we are doing what we need with permit conditions.
Okay, thank you. I'll go to Representative Quam and then Nadeau. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On the list, there was someone from the Water Well Association because I was hoping to get some clarification.
But he took himself off the list.
Right. No, so I'm going to ask and probably end up having to get offline, but I'd like to understand shallow versus mid and deep aquifers. What an analysis of local, so you avoid utilizing local drinking water aquifers in the area, and some of the more technical specifics because of in the rural areas, rural residents often use the shallow aquifer because it's thousands of dollars less to put in. But there is generally more risk of contamination and other issues, and that's why there's quite a bit of monitoring. With appropriate techniques, there's probably not a great deal of risk with this type of a project, but if it avoids the generally used aquifer for drinking water, that would decrease the window or avenue for risk. The other thing is that some of the aquifers that are highly utilized, when the flow or the content is decreased from public use, if it was used for something else and there was a little bit of contamination, then the probability of a concentration reaching a level that would be of concern is increased. So I'd sort of like to understand what some of the general guidelines are, and we can probably give the committee that later on, because this is for possible inclusion, correct?
Correct. We don't have a fiscal note yet.
Right. And so the idea is to make sure that there are, intelligent, logical procedures and policies in place. I like the idea of utilizing the geothermal. But I want to make sure when we implement and change that we reassure the citizens of a decreased risk. So those are the areas that I had concern with. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you. I'm not sure if there was an actual question there. Representative Akam, did you anything you wanted to say about that?
Well, I would say maybe look to the technical experts about what depth they're or if that is determined through this kind of technology. Within the bill, there is language on 2.1 and 2.2 that talk about any conditions deemed necessary to protect the public health and safety of groundwater. So the department will have authority and jurisdiction to help oversee and ensure the things that you're bringing up.
Okay, so let's go to Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And quickly, I'm curious on line 1.17 and 1.18. So it sounds like, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, that there's three projects that are currently being considered or worked on or getting ready to be constructed. And again, I apologize. I'm far more familiar with ground source heat pumps than I am thermal exchange, practices. But you're changing the language in 1.17 from 10 to 100 permits that may be issued for larger systems, which is a pretty significant increase when it sounds like when we have three. What's the reason for that, number one? So that's the first question, and I'm trying to be quick. And then 1.18, I'm curious as to, of the three projects that are being proposed right now, they obviously exceed 50 gallons per minute. And I'm wondering what they exceed that amount by.
Those are good.
Representative Akam.
Sorry, Madam Chair. Those are great questions. And I will say I'm not a technical expert, though we do have some that are with us today. When we look at increasing its capacity, currently, as described in my introduction, it really only allows for the heating and cooling of a smaller building. And so having a larger building, needing more capacity. But as far as your second question, I would look to maybe some technical experts if the gentleman from the Mayo would be willing to come back.
Sure.
Yeah.
Or Ms.
Or do you have to
say your name again for me? I'm sorry.
Teresa Purrington.
Purrington.
Yes.
Okay. Ms. Purrington, did you want to take a crack at that, or would you?
I'm curious of the specific question, because there were two. So what specific one do you need?
Representative Nadeau.
Yes, Madam Chair. The specific question for you is, the language is being changed in 1.18. Currently, there's a limit to 50 gallons per minute for a large system, 20 to 50. I'm wondering why we're striking that, and so it's over 20. We're getting rid of that limitation. And it seems to me, the more gallons being used, and recirculated back into our water table, the more risk there is. And I know that it's a closed system somewhat, but it's not really. And I'm wondering why we're increasing that and to what extent the current projects under proposal have exceeded the current limit of 50 gallons.
Okay. Ms. Purrington, does that help?
Madam Chair, thank you. And thank committee members, thank you for the question. I can't specifically ask about these projects, of what the gallon type. I think that would be better answered by the project owner.
Okay, Mr. Roll, please come on up. So, Ms. Purrington, you can be off the hot seat for a few minutes. Thank you.
But don't go far.
Okay, welcome back. You might want to just state your name again, please.
Yes, Jack Rawl with the Mayo Clinic in Rochester.
Okay, Mr. Rawl, go ahead if you can address that.
Madam Chair, members, yes, the current design for the Mayo system, I can't speak to the Evergreen projects, the Mayo systems are 750 gallons per minute.
Representative Nadeau?
That's pretty significant.
That's pretty significant, yes. Again, these systems are meant to provide heating and cooling for large developments. So that 50 would, like Representative Aiken said, is really intended for a home, for a single family home.
Representative Nadeau.
Just one quick follow up then, Madam Chair. I mean, what would happen? I mean, should there be a limit? I mean, 10,000 gallons a minute? I mean, I know how difficult it is in rural areas to get a permit for a well that I mean, it's impossible. So I'm just curious, should there be an upper limit, or should, for example, a county decide that they're, or a city going to say, we're going to heat and cool our whole community, and we're going to use 200 million gallons a minute. I'm making that number up. I mean, should there be an upper limit? It just seems like there should be. This is a relatively new technology, and we're just opening it up for anybody to kind of use whatever water resources there are. And I'm concerned about not understanding the science behind this and wondering if this is a safe thing for us to do.
So thank you, Representative Jones. So, Mr. Roll, you know, we didn't really spend much time sort of describing what the technology really is. So maybe you could give us a little, because my understanding is that you're not polluting groundwater. So when we say we use X amount, we're not really using it in the sense of if you were drawing it out of a well, for example.
Madam,
Mr. Roll.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Representatives, you're correct. So the wells, specifically at the Rochester project, we take groundwater from approximately 375 feet. It is pumped up from an extraction well through a mechanical piece. It never sees the environment once it's pumped out of that well. It recirculates through a mechanical heating and cooling device and then is injected back into the earth at the same depth at 375 feet. So, yes, you are correct. It's never, once it comes out of the ground, it never sees the light of day and then is injected back in.
Representative Aiken.
And Madam Chair, if I may, I will just say that this isn't new technology, and it's technology that the department has been permitting and overseeing for a number of years. And during that time, they have been, once a year, and in some cases up to four times a year, monitoring particular projects and particular development. And so there has been a track record of safety and lack of a risk. And so I think that's why the department feels as though, with continued oversight and partnership with developers, that there's the ability to move forward in a larger fashion. And so, as I stated earlier, the department will continue to implement conditions where necessary and oversight every step of the way.
So, okay, thank you. Representative Nadeau, I think your question is very well taken. Mm-hmm. And so I think we could, something to think about when the bill gets laid over and, you know, whether putting a cap in there would make sense, I think is a very, you know, good thought. So we have Keel, Murphy, Fisher, and then I hope to lay the bill over. So Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wondered if the department could just explain it's 2.1 and 2.2. What is the thought process about any permit conditions deemed necessary to protect the public health and safety of groundwater? Why is that added?
Ms. Purrington.
Madam Chair, committee members, thank you for the question. For these systems, you guys have communicated that it is an increase from 50 gallons per minute to no limit. This provides us the opportunity to obtain information and review information to ensure that we are protecting the public health and the groundwater. These systems are larger than the 50 gallons per minute, and these larger capacity systems provides us the opportunity to review that information, and these current rules that we do regulate didn't have these larger capacity limits, so it will provide us that opportunity that our rule did intend in the first place.
Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. I just want to kind of get folks to take a look at lines 2.8 and 2.9 on there. Is what this does is this links us back to the original issue that was raised by Representative Nadeau, is, you know, what do we need for a limit out there? And the Department of Natural Resources has the capacity and requirement in state statute already where they are required to only issue permits for water use if it is done in a sustainable way. And this is one of the issues that we have in the water world, is that a lot of the permits and stuff you need crossover between different areas. So the Department of Natural Resources determines how much water you can use and is going to have an impact on the environment. And if so, they have the right to issue a permit or not issue, and that's where you get the limits, where the Department of Health comes from the safety concerns. Is it going to be something that contaminates the water, et cetera? And then the MPCA also gets a say in other areas of the water world. And this is part of the problems why sometimes this gets confusing. So I want to say that as I see how the bill is written right here, is we still have the other double check in there that if anything was being done that would impact the environmental conditions and not be sustainable, the Department of Natural Resources could still deny the permit or not allow it to be expanded beyond a certain point. So the way the bill is written, I think it addresses the problems that are out there, because we have two different departments looking at both all the issues involved.
Thank you, Representative Fisher. That's very helpful. It's great to have a member with that broad expertise that you bring, because I know you've been working on water issues for quite some time. So thank you for that. Any final comment, Representative Akin, before we lay it over?
No, I thank you for the discussion and the questions. Appreciate the partnership. And this will be laid over so we can continue to work on this.
All right. So thank you. So with that, House File 4096 is laid over for possible inclusion. Okay, we will go now to House File 4098, Representative Hemmingson-Yeager. And Representative Hemmingson-Yeager moves that House File 4098 be laid over for possible inclusion. And let's see, we do have an author's amendment, the A1, to put the bill in the order in which the author would like to discuss it. So all in favor of adoption, Representative Hemmingson-Yeager is moving the A1 amendment. Right, Representative Hemmingson-Yeager?
Yes, please.
Yes. And all in favor of adoption, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. And so to your bill as amended.
Great. Thank you. Thank you for your time and attention. This bill is a Board of Pharmacy bill. And long story short, this basically closes a loophole for third-party logistics providers. It clarifies reporting if there are zero reportable distributions occurring. There are no concerns from the pharmacy community, and the fiscal note is zero.
All right. Very good. Okay. And so I see you have Dr. Phillips at the table. Did you want to say anything about the bill?
Anything to add? If I may speak to the...
Please, just please introduce yourself and go ahead.
I'm Jill Phillips, the Executive Director of the Board of Pharmacy.
Please, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, committee members. Again, my name is Jill Phillips. I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Pharmacy, and I'm here testifying in support of House File 4098. And I just wanted to add and take a moment to address just a couple of concerns that were brought forth by the Association for Accessible Medicines in opposition of the bill.
Okay, Dr. Phillips, we haven't heard that yet. We may. Maybe we should let them tell us what their opposition might be, and then maybe we could have you respond to that afterwards.
Absolutely.
Okay. So, Mr. Selwood, come on down. So, right. So, Dr. Phillips, if you would, like, sit back there, and then we'll have you back. Okay. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Joe Selwood, and I'm testifying on behalf of the Association for Accessible Medicines, the leading trade association for manufacturers of the generic and biosimilar prescription drugs that save Minnesota and its patients $5.7 billion in 2022 alone. AAM opposes House File 4098 because it's an unnecessary expansion beyond the intent or scope of the opioid law. The opiate product registration fee program requires a manufacturer engaged in the production of an opiate to report every sale, distribution, or other distribution of an opiate into the state. And that's because the opiate product registration fee applies only to manufacturers of opiates. These fees are paid by roughly 100 manufacturers at either $55,000 or $305,000 per year based on volume, generating around $15 million annually. This is in addition to the $564 million secured in the opioid settlements, primarily from other parties. Nearly all of the manufacturers paying the opiate product registration fee have not and are not involved in the opioid settlements. House File 4098 significantly expands the opiate product registration fee by applying the reporting requirements to an additional 1,000 drug manufacturers who do not make opiates. Generic drug manufacturers must comply with a variety of reporting requirements, but what's unusual here is this idea of negative reporting, requiring a report to state that you do not need to report. House File 4098 expands the $500 per day penalty to all manufacturers, a liability not intended for those who do not produce opiates. In the board's recent report evaluating the opiate product registration fee, it notes that that in addition to reports from manufacturers of opiates and the distributors, the board receives additional validating records from the Automation of Reports and Consolidated Order System, or ARCOS, operated by the DEA, and then, quote, performs an analysis to calculate the total number of opiate units that were distributed for each manufacturer, end quote. The board receives the information they need through multiple channels, and they have the ability to enforce compliance through penalties. Requiring 1,000 additional manufacturers to annually report that they do not do something is not necessary. Because of these reasons, AAM opposes House File 4098.
Okay, thank you. And so now, Dr. Phillips, if you want to come up and... Okay, welcome back.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In response to that, again, currently manufacturers and wholesalers report only if there are opiate distributions, sales, or deliveries in the previous calendar year, but this makes compliance difficult as not everyone is required to report. So, again, the board is very supportive of language to specify that all manufacturers and wholesalers must report to the board if nothing was distributed. And the comment that this requirement will not provide useful information for the Board of Pharmacy to manage this program is not correct. These reports provide very useful information that will enable the board to know whether or not a manufacturer or wholesaler distributed opiates into our state and then appropriately assess if any outstanding distributions exist that are unaccounted for. Without this language, the board is unable to determine if a licensee failed to report their opiate distributions or if they simply did not have any distributions to report. And also the comment that it creates additional work. The board already does this. The reports are due March 1st of each year, and prior to the state, our agency sends out a blast email reminding all of our manufacturers and wholesaler licensees that it's time to report. And we do instruct them to submit a zero report if no opiate distributions were made in the previous year. So we're already doing this in practice, and many of the manufacturers and wholesalers provide this information. So we would just like to make it a requirement for all. And then lastly, the concern related to the $500 per day penalty for failure to report. This is reserved for very egregious cases. And in the time that this program has been implemented, we've had one case where that penalty was applied, and it was an egregious case where there was a significant number of opiates that went unreported, and it actually resulted in two manufacturers being assessed the $250,000 opiate fee that would have otherwise not been caught. So that is not the intent. And again, licensees can easily avoid the penalty by simply reporting on time. So thank you, committee members, and Madam you. Chair, I appreciate the
and
time.
And Dr. Phillips, is there, if somebody is assessed this penalty, is there an appeals process for that?
I would have to just validate whether it's formal or not. We would allow for one.
Okay. Representative Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I appreciate the testifiers. I didn't catch initially the change in definitions for both a manufacturer and a wholesaler. And we just heard that this will loop in an additional 1,000 manufacturers. That's 10 times the number of manufacturers. And those are folks who don't distribute opioids in the state of Minnesota. And I'm wondering if we know, if anybody knows how many additional wholesalers this will loop in. Because now it's all wholesalers, not those that just that distribute opiates.
Dr. Phillips?
Again, we send out the notification to all manufacturers and wholesaler licensees. We already do this. And so, a good majority of them comply with this. And if they did not distribute any opiates into our state, they fill out that zero report. It's a simple activity, and they comply with it, even though it's not currently a requirement. So, this isn't adding on to the number of manufacturers that we're already reaching out and wholesalers that we're already reaching out to remind them that it's time to report.
Representative Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you. That was not my question. I understand your position that this creates no additional work for the board. I understand that. The board is sending this out to all manufacturers, all wholesalers. However, this increases the onus on 10 times the number of manufacturers. We are exponentially increasing the number of manufacturers we now loop into this requirement. And I was hoping that we knew how many wholesalers as well this would expand. And I have a real concern about requiring negative reporting, that it doesn't make sense to me that if you are not engaged in an activity in the state of Minnesota, that you would have to tell someone that you are not engaged in an activity in the state of Minnesota. And I hope we can all see the problems that could create in so many areas. This is sort of an odd requirement, and particularly now I understand the current board reserves the administrative penalty for only egregious cases, but that's not what the law allows for. The law literally reads $500 per day. So if you are a day late, it's $500 for every day. And now I can imagine a great deal of confusion by adding 900 additional manufacturers and who knows how many wholesalers. I can imagine folks going, I don't do that. I don't know why I would report that, and it becoming a problem. This is really, I see this as really problematic and could really spin, just this negative reporting requirement is very odd. And again, I appreciate the testimony because I did not recognize for whatever reason, it didn't click the change in the definitions of manufacturer and wholesaler. Initially. Thank you, Madam Chair.
So my understanding, Dr. Phillips, is that you're really clarifying current practice, so just making kind of codifying current practice.
That is absolutely correct.
Okay. And the other piece is that to Representative Brindley, where it says may assess an administrative penalty. It doesn't say will, has to, anything like that. And I think we see this in lots and lots of places in law. I just remember I'm having deja vu on this very conversation because, you know, plenty of our agencies have this kind of language and really don't use this unless it's, as Dr. Phillips said, an egregious situation. But Representative New Brindley.
But Madam Chair, I would just clarify that this is the current practice of the board. It is the current practice of the board to send out all of this information. This is not the current practice of 900 manufacturers, or excuse me, 1,000 manufacturers, and who knows how many wholesalers.
Well,
it's not their practice. So just to be very clear about that.
Yeah, so Dr. Phillips, so let's clarify that, because my understanding was that most are already reporting zero, and that you're just codifying that. Are we asking lots of new people to report who aren't currently reporting?
No, there's no change there. And again, as stated, a number of them already comply and provide that zero report back to us. So we're not reaching out to new people other than the 3PLs.
Okay, so how many are new ones would you expect now to have this requirement to report who are not currently doing it? I think that's where we're really trying to figure this out.
So we have approximately, again, around 900 wholesalers, and we have an additional 300 3PLs. 300 third-party logistics providers. My apologies.
Okay. Representative New Brindley, anything further?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I appreciate that the 900 wholesaler number. Are you saying that is how many – this would now include 1,100 manufacturers instead of 100 manufacturers. So my question is, you say a number of them already report the negative. What is that number?
Dr. Phillips.
I couldn't tell you off the top of my head. I just know that a good portion, everyone has already reached out to, and a good percentage of them already comply.
Madam Chair.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right.
That just seems like an important thing to know, because we're told, well, lots of them already do. Well, does lots mean 200 instead of 100? Does it mean 1,000 instead of 1,100? Those are very different numbers, and this is a big change for all those folks.
Okay. We're going to lay the bill over, and maybe Dr. Phillips can find that number for us.
Absolutely.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think as a general principle, Minnesota cannot impose a law on someone that's not doing business in Minnesota. I think it just comes down to that. And if Minnesota did impose a law on someone outside Minnesota, then federal courts would rule against, and you'd have, you'd have fiscal notes because you're doing something that isn't legal. I mean, it's beyond interstate commerce. It's they're not an entity in the boundaries of our state, doing business in the boundaries of our state. So we do not have purview to legislate upon them any requirement or burden. And the excuse of may doesn't exclude you don't do what you're not legally allowed to do. So I think that's part of the frustration maybe you've seen today is let's cover people that are doing business in Minnesota appropriately and, you know, not have legislation that is of poor standing on a federal level. Thank you, Madam Chair.
So, Representative Hemmings-Yeager, do you have a real short closing comment? We're going to lay it over.
Yes, thank you. Back in my science day, my lab science days, zero reporting can actually be very valuable data. That tells us that they are active, but they are not distributing or manufacturing or selling anything. So that actually is valuable data. What is compelling to me about this language is it is codifying current practice, and this is really tracking the movement of opiates through our community. So these third-party logistics, we need to make sure where and track where these opiates are going. We have an epidemic. And as far as conducting business in Minnesota, these third-party logistics providers do need to be licensed under Minnesota statute. So they are following Minnesota laws, and we want to make sure that we are keeping track of what is going through our state.
All right, thank you. So House File 4098, as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion. We'll now take up House File 4099. Representative Hemmings-Yeager moves that House File 4099 is laid over. No. Yes, laid over for possible inclusion. I don't think we have an amendment on this one. To 4099. Representative Hemmings-Yeager.
Great. Thank you again for the continued discussion. This is another Board of Pharmacy bill that focuses on relocation fees. This adds clarity to when a fee is assessed, clarifies that licenses cannot be transferred. And again, this is representing current practice, applies to wholesaling manufacturers to increase consistency. Again, no concerns from the pharmacy community, and the fiscal note actually shows a little bit of savings.
All right, thank you. So we don't have anyone signed up to testify for this bill. Not seeing any members on the list, so House File 4099 is laid over for possible inclusion. All right. Can we take up your bill, Representative Ryer, and get started, or we've got a few minutes? Okay. House File, so Representative Ryer is going to move that House File 3529 be re-referred to the Committee on Commerce, Finance, and Policy. There's an author's amendment to put the bill in its intended form for discussion. So Representative Ryer moves the House, moves the A1. Is that correct, Representative Ryer? And so all in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. To your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I appreciate the opportunity to present House File 3529. Which requires health maintenance organizations, HMOs, in Minnesota to be nonprofit. This legislation restores a standard that was changed in 2017 and will return the industry to a more patient and provider-centered focus. The bill is straightforward. It updates six sections of Chapter 62D to require that HMOs must be a nonprofit corporation organized in Minnesota or a local government unit, instead of a foreign or domestic corporation or local government unit as written in current law. It also includes a new section, Section 7, that outlines a transition plan for HMO business currently operated by for-profit HMOs. The transition is scheduled to be complete by December 31st, 2025. There are fundamental differences between for-profit and nonprofit health plans that drive the need for this bill. The key, though, is who the organization exists to benefit. The nonprofit plans in Minnesota have historically been charged with looking out for the health of Minnesotans. A general definition of nonprofit says it well. A nonprofit corporation's purpose and activities must serve the organization's mission to benefit the public and may not be operated to profit other persons or entities. In contrast, the responsibility of for-profit organizations is to shareholders and the delivery of financial results that satisfy market expectations. When we changed this law in 2017, concerns were raised that nonprofit plans would be at a disadvantage. In fact, there were bipartisan comments that making sure that nonprofits could compete fairly was important. Now in 2024, we see that the playing field is not level. For example, for-profit companies are advantaged by having broader portfolios and being able to hold on to more assets. For-profit plans' market position in Minnesota is limited right now, so it's time to act. We've seen the outcomes of industry consolidation in the healthcare system and other markets. It has led to higher prices and lower quality. We need only look at the performance differences in the Medicare Advantage program between for-profit and nonprofit HMOs. We're in the position now to halt, to protect the longer-term well-being of our healthcare system by halting the growth of for-profit plans in Minnesota. In closing, I ask for your support for this bill as we seek to improve our healthcare system to ensure that all Minnesotans have ready access to affordable, high-quality health care. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Ryer. Is there anyone in the room who wants to testify for or against the bill? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Ryer, and members. Michelle Benson with the Health Plan Partnership of Minnesota. Our members include Cigna, Allina, Allina Health, and United Healthcare. I appreciate this opportunity. Last year, the legislature requested a report on HMO conversion. This report was to be released in two parts. February of 2024, we received a preliminary report, and the remainder will be available in June of 2022. If Minnesota were to return, if this bill passes, Minnesota would return to its pre-2017 status, being an outlier by being the only state that doesn't allow for-profit HMOs. The report states clearly that right now the information is inconclusive. If you turn to the executive summary, it states minimal data are available to shed light on whether differences exist between nonprofit and for-profit HMOs with regard to day-to-day operation, enrollee satisfaction, or quality of care. Those aren't my words. Those are the words from a report that this committee requested. All HMOs, regardless of status, are subject to oversight by both the Department of Health and the Department of Commerce. There are no exceptions. All HMOs, regardless of status, are subject to a medical loss ratio. All HMOs must compete for enrollees by having strong provider networks, competitive rates, and satisfying the people they serve. Consumers and employers are free to choose the best value they find in options for coverage. No HMO can charge more or provide less, because they would simply not be chosen, regardless of their status as for-profit or nonprofit. HMOs, regardless of status, are subject to medical loss ratios at both the federal and state levels. Any excess funds are required by law to be returned to enrollees. Additionally, the Minnesota Department of Health gathers vast amounts of information reported on an A1 report to ensure that only allowed expenses are included to be charged out in our public programs. I'll send members a copy of this report later. I didn't bring it with me here today because, well, I'm an accountant and I might find it fascinating. What you really need to take from it is that there's extensive reporting regardless of your status, whether you're a for-profit or a nonprofit. The playing field is level between these two types of entities. Many of you will remember.
I'm going to ask you to wrap up, please.
Oh, sorry. Many of you will remember a few years ago when a plan exited the market and the chaos that caused for medical assistance enrollees. Removing options from the market will result in that same chaos. And HMOs, regardless of status, are part of complex organizations. Again, Appendix C will show you how complex even nonprofit HMOs are in their organizations. The report coming in June will shed more light. And I believe in that report, you will note insignificant differences between for-profit and nonprofit HMOs. The health plan partnership.
I really need you to wrap up, please.
Is opposed to Health File 3529 as we are community partners, employers, and are dedicated to giving value to our enrollees. Thank you, Madam Chair, for letting me go over time.
Representative Ryer, any final word?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that the input that many of us receive from our constituents about concerns with the performance that they've received speaks for itself, and I ask for your support.
All right. With that, Representative Ryer renews her motion.
Wait, Matt, are we going to bring this up for discussion?
Well, I'm sorry, I didn't see your hand, Representative New Brindley. I was kind of looking at the list and didn't see anyone on it. So, Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I can't imagine that I'm the only one who wants to ask some questions about this. I've got a couple of questions.
Benson, you can sit down. You know, thank
Madam
you.
Madam Chair, thank you.
And you know, my questions revolve around a lot of the things that were said. Representative Ryer, you said that they've resulted in higher prices and lower quality. There's even some stuff in the language of the bill that's questionable as far as that goes. So my question is, there is extensive reporting. So, I get anecdotally you have people who have talked to you and said that they're not happy with it, but I'm wondering if you can point me to the data that shows the differences between the nonprofits and the for-profits and how they are functioning in Minnesota.
Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative New Brindley. I will send you references to abundant reporting from KFF and other organizations, academic journals that have documented the impact of this transition to for-profit health plans.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would very much appreciate seeing that supporting data, because right now we're not seeing it, and we certainly have not seen it from our own departments here in Minnesota. And so I do think that this is premature. We don't have that data here in Minnesota. While extensive reporting is happening, and so I guess I know we're out of time, but there are just, it seems odd that we would cause this disruption in the system when we literally do not know what's happening in the state of Minnesota. We don't know. And in fact, you know, I mean, is Representative Bierman in this committee? Oh, yes, exactly. We were on a panel together. And I actually said, you know, we should have data on things like claim denials and things like this so that we know. Is it more extensive in the for-profit plans? Because that would be problematic, obviously, for our constituents. But we don't have that. We don't have that. And so I'm not sure why we are eliminating competition. I would also just say, you know, going back to we held an extensive hearing on managed care before session, and literally one of the testifiers who probably was certainly most in favor of eliminating managed care organizations also said, there really isn't a difference in not-for-profit or for-profit. So this is, I mean, I get that there is a personal, and not you personally, but there is a personal bias against for-profit companies. But this just seems to be exclusively punishment, not based on data, which I think is problematic. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Representative Nadeau and then Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Ryer. And this is I think this is an important topic that we're talking about. You know, we all feel better in Minnesota because we have so many options with nonprofits. I mean, not only in healthcare delivery, but also our direct service providers for disabled communities and all the other people that we deliver services for. And I happen to have for-profit and nonprofit direct service providers that I work with at the county. And they meet all the same standards. They are required to meet all the same reporting requirements. They deliver the same services. Probably 10 or maybe 15% of my providers are for-profit. It's dominated by nonprofits. And we feel good about that. And I want to make sure that far too often we end up our feelings end up displacing and dispelling science. And Representative New Brindley is right. There isn't data to support eliminating an option for people. I mean, if we're going to be here and say 49 states are wrong, and we're the only ones, and we're Minnesota, and we're going to do this better, and we're going to get rid of this, I hope that we would make that decision based on data and science rather than the belief that, you know, for-profit corporations are bad. They're not bad. I was just at a fundraiser the other day, and there was a bunch of, you know, and this was for disabled service provision. And the greatest people in the room were the corporations that were standing up there and giving money to provide services. They're not bad. They're not bad. And so if there's data and if there's evidence and the Kaiser reports that you're going to send, maybe those are national studies. There is no study in Minnesota that will defend getting rid of for-profit healthcare providers. And they're serving 40,000 people in Minnesota. That's it. Small percentage. So I just hope that if this continues, if it's laid over, if you continue to work on it, you know, that we really make decisions based on data. And that's it. And I will be right there with you. I'll be arm in arm. And if there's a reduction in service, if denials are higher, we can address those things, and I'll be right there. But right now, I just think this is premature until we get the rest of the studies done. So thank you.
Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my first question is about the testimony that was submitted on the comprehensive one. The link on the website, pages 4 and 5, there's 2 pages of written testimony, but there's no name attached to that or any organization. Is there, could we get some light shed on that? On
okay,
who that?
Mr. Sandy's going to check on that. So why don't you ask your second question, Representative Schumacher?
Madam Chair. That was my only question. I was just going to also make the point that there's been discussion in this hearing today about the transition to for-profits, but there really isn't any discussion about conversions in the bill. There's transitioning them, closing or eliminating the for-profit, but no transition from not-for-profit to for-profit, which I think is maybe getting muddled in the conversation today. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Schumacher, this staff here will, if it's okay with you, will talk with you offline about that issue. There might be some misunderstanding about that. I don't know if talking about conversion, and we need to get wrapped up here, but I don't know if, Representative Breyer, what I'm going to do is just let you have the last word and go ahead and address that in your closing comment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, this is not a bill about the whole conversion matter. There's a whole other bill about that, I believe, but this is about laying out a pathway so that people who are doing business in Minnesota with the permission of Minnesota have a clear pathway, and the members have a clear pathway to know what's going to happen so that it isn't a sudden disruptive change. I would point out that now is exactly the time to do it because there isn't a great deal of business and there are fewer people to disrupt. And I also just want to close by saying this is much, much more discussion than this issue had in 2017 when we changed the law so that for-profit plans could enter the market. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. So with that, Representative Ryer renews her motion that House File 3529 as amended be re-referred to the Committee on Commerce, Finance, and Policy. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. The bill is on its way to Commerce. And with that, we are adjourned.